podcast from Said Business School, University of Oxford, and Kantar, the marketing insights and consulting company. In each episode, we'll have a frank discussion with industry experts to help brands and business leaders navigate the changing landscape of marketing and hopefully dispel some myths.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And misconceptions along the way.
Mary Giyakidi, Global Thought Leader at Kantar, and I'm delighted to be here today with Mark Reedson. Mark, you're a professional of marketing. You're a columnist. You're a multi-award winner. But to me, Mark, you seem like a man who's been on a mission to fix marketing. Now, I find that you're very quick at pointing out stuff in general. So whether it's about brands that have chosen to stay in Russia, or all those that are flying the rainbow flag rather meaninglessly. And you even pointed the finger at fellow influencers, urging us all to rebel against hugely popular advice, and in fact, to do the opposite of what they're advising us to do. Now, this is probably the world's longest introduction, but I'm going somewhere with it, because my question to you is, I get the feeling that you're not enjoying it unless you create a little bit of tension. Is that right?
I mean, you've got to remember, I'm a columnist, right? And people forget that sometimes. That, I mean, you've done mini MBA, right?
Yeah.
I'm a different person in that classroom than I am when I'm writing for Marketing Week, right? People who've read my column turn up expecting it to be more kind of provocative. And provocation doesn't work that well in the classroom. Do you know what I mean? So I'm playing a bit of a role as a columnist, which is, you know, most marketing columnists are incredibly boring and say the same things every single time. And yeah. So, yeah, I think I am. I'm looking for things that are interesting and hopefully, you know, you want to, if you're a columnist, I think you need half the people to agree with you and half the people to disagree with you. But you can't say something just for the sake of splitting them. You have to believe what you're saying. Otherwise, you're full of shit too. So, yeah, no, I like it. Look, the thing that drove me, Mary, from the beginning was, as a very junior, useless professor, I just wanted anyone in marketing to read anything as an academic that I'd written, right? You've got to remember, again, that 99% of marketing professors in the UK, US, France, everywhere, will spend their whole lives writing shit that no one in marketing will ever read. And I just didn't want to be one of those losers. That was the most important thing to me 25 years ago, right? So I think that's where it all comes from, is it's just great to be, I'm honored to be read by people that do marketing. That's the main goal, you know?
And they do read you. And, you know, you mentioned that you're different as a teacher. You're different on the course and you're different when you're writing. And I can testify to that. You're rather nurturing as a teacher. And I think, you have an unconventional approach to teaching. I mean, you even appear naked in one of the modules, kind of. Well, yeah.
And Mary, with a body like mine, for things like that, you've got to get it out, Mary. I mean, it's what everybody wants. You can't keep that hidden. You know what I'm saying?
But no, I know what you mean. But regardless of the number of items of clothing you're wearing, you know, what struck me as different is your actual approach to being a teacher, because you keep it on after the course has ended. So you keep it on for your alumni group. So the for me, and I can speak from personal experience, you've helped me. You know, I've asked for advice and you've given it to me. Yeah. You've even helped me with the structure of one of the pieces. So it's a very practical question. I mean, do you do this for everyone? Do you find the time?
Well, it's the only thing I do now. So, yeah, I mean, when I was a professor in the real world, you know, which I did for a very long time, there's always, I mean, I was trained to be a proper professor, trained to teach case studies and teach MBAs. So once you have an MBA that you've taught, they are still connections. I mean, I have connections back to, you know, London Business School in 1999, someone I was talking to last week who was asking me something, you know. And yeah, there's a bond there that absolutely you retain, and I don't see any difference with mini MBA. I have a couple of conversations a day with alumni from mini MBA, and it's great because you know I got a message this morning from a woman that went to work for, I don't want to mention her by name because it wouldn't be fair, but she went to work for one of the large tech companies. I recommended her on the back of mini MBA. She loves it. They love her. And she was saying, as a Muslim woman, it's very interesting. She says, a Muslim woman, she said it was really, for some reason, she said it was even harder for me to have confidence that I could do this. I just seemed like a double outsider. She didn't have a formal training in marketing. She felt, as a Muslim woman, she wasn't in the center of things and she was an outsider. And yet now she's right in the middle of it and she's kicking goals, you know, and it's just the loveliest thing to help people.
I've been writing about the modern marketing dilemmas, and some of these things I've explored as well. And a lot of the times, obviously, I reference you because I find you make sense. Now, the first one was on marketing ROI, and you don't talk nicely about marketing ROI. No. You call it names. You say it's stupid. You say it's a silly metric, and then you add to some degree. So I would like us to deconstruct this last bit a little bit. So to what degree is attribution wrong?
Well, it's I'm deliberately hard on it because it's so dominant in a lot of places, right? That you have to show an ROI or it doesn't make sense. So I'm deliberately rhetorical about it being stupid just to stop people short, right? And when I've worked with clients, I had a famous meeting with one client where they were banging on and on and on about ROI. And I said to them, I can't stand this anymore. You're going to lose so much money with this ridiculous focus on ROI, which got everyone's attention, right? Because you've got to kind of play the game a little bit. There's nothing wrong with ROI for performance marketing. Clearly, it makes perfect. If you're at the bottom of the funnel, if you're investing X amount in a digital tool for 3 weeks, you can clearly very quickly attribute the success and work out the value of the success versus the cost. And I think ROI is incredibly appropriate. The problem is further up the funnel with the brand building stuff. Just because we can't show an immediate or even delayed ROI does not mean that it's not giving us a significant impact and return. So just because I can't measure it doesn't mean it isn't there. It's nonsensical at the higher brand level. It's perfectly sensible at the performance level. But when you take the expectations of ROI up to the top of the funnel for brand building, it means that you go, well, there's nothing here. Let's put more money into short term. And that's where it goes. Right?
Yeah,
it's a half good measure. It's a half good measure, and it's a half bad measure.
Mm. Yes, I mean, we've been talking a lot about how marketing creates value, you know, via brands, how they create value through brands' valuable mental connections. And this is often understated because marketers still, with all the evidence that is out there, and we have put out some stuff, still tend to look at the short-term benefits as proof of their work. With pride, they show it in the boardroom. But what we would like to do continuously, and we're on a mission to do that, we want to make sure that they use a far wider definition of the value that a brand creates. But we'll get to that actually when we talk a little bit about brand equity later on. But let me ask you a little bit about brand equity. I know you believe in brand equity, and I suppose it is actually, because I wanted to write about stuff that people search for. And it's one of the evergreen topics, our marketing team told me. So people tend to search for it a lot, and because they want to understand what it means. And I suppose in very simple terms, it's the combo of mental and physical availability, right? And the magic that takes place when these two overlap for a brand.
Yeah. You can look at it that way. I mean, it's a bit too Ehrenberg-Bassian for my taste, but you could go at it that way, right? Brand equity is best defined as the difference between the commodity and the brand. Mm-hmm. So if we take, I'm trying to think of a good example. If we take market research, the commodity, out of Kantar, what's left over in the client's mind? Yeah. Yes. And that includes obviously mental availability and awareness, mm-hmm. but it also includes associations and hopefully a price premium and an expectation of performance and so on and so on. So that's what brand equity fundamentally means. What have you got over and above the commodity version? And many companies don't have anything. And as a result of that, we get price premium, we get better sales, we get, you know, all organizational stuff and so on and so on. For me, that's always been the heart of the definition. Do you know what I mean? Do you know, what does Coke have over cola?
Cinnamon. So and tell me a little bit about that. The there's been a lot of emphasis recently on the future buyers and the value of that the future buyers will bring. So we've read research from the B2B Institute for LinkedIn about their 95-5 rule. So consumers are not in the market to buy right now. I mean, most of them aren't. So the emphasis, I suppose, for that only should be on mental availability. So on the chance that future buyers will come to you when a key decision is to be made, when the time is right for them, when they finally enter the category.
Yeah, I mean, I think the team there at the LinkedIn, at the B2B Marketing Institute, they're doing great work, right? I mean, they're doing fantastic work. And this 95%, 5%, I was using it this morning with a client. Mm-hmm. It really helps rhetorically to try and explain to sales-driven tech boys that if 19 out of 20 of your customers aren't buying right now, why are you spending all your time worrying about the sales force? Why don't you put some of your money into building brand to prepare the client for when they do come into the market? So I think it's a brilliant statistic. Whether or not it's true is a different question, but that's not the point, right? That's B2B. In B2C, clearly the numbers are slightly different. It varies by category, but absolutely, it all comes back to the same thing. Sales and marketing are the same thing. The funnel, the top of funnel and bottom funnel are working off the same thing. And we tend to dislocate these two things and talk about sales as if it's different from marketing, which in the market it's not, right? Marketing is setting up the sale at the top of the funnel, and sales is winning the business and getting the repeat business. And clearly having a sales force building brand and awareness and consideration is dumb from a resources point of view. Yeah, marketing is about setting up the sale, building the brand, allowing us to make an easier sale at a higher price point. You know, we'll see in the recession how that plays out, because, again, one of the great fascinating moments of a recession, which we surely now have, is that most idiot companies will cut the long of it. And if they retain any marketing spend, it will go on short-term ROI. It's completely the wrong way around if you study history. Completely the wrong way around, right? But, you know, the few smart companies that understand, you just keep building brands because this is a 5, 10, 15-year mission and the recession will only last 12, 16, 18 months, will come out in great shape. And we've seen that literally a dozen times across a dozen recessions in the last century. Nobody learns, but we'll see it again. You know, we'll see it play out over the next 2 years.
Yes. To your point about whether this research is true or not, or what it's based on, we've done a lot of research on that, but for B2C brands, and because we wanted to understand what gets a brand chosen in the end and by consumers, and we've discovered that the consumer decision journey is a feedback loop, in a sense that, you know, there are three facets, as we say, of the consumer decision journey: the experience, equity, and activation. And equity contributes by far the largest percentage in the growth. And in that equity, obviously, we talk about brand equity and the future buyers, and predisposing them to your brand is part of that. So another very beloved topic of mine is the one around distinctiveness and differentiation. And I don't want to put versus in there in between, but often it is about versus. So it is about, I suppose it's the topic of whether brand perceptions influence sales or not. And I know you mentioned Herman Bass Institute before, and I know you disagree with them on that. So you say there are great benefits that will come from measuring and valuing brand image. So just tell me simply, does a product, do you think, need to be more than a product to break through consumers' expectations of parity and have more chances of being chosen?
Yeah, look, so let's rewind back. So what happens during the 70s and 80s is we get high on differentiation, right? Differentiate or die, right? If you don't differentiate, you'll go out of business, right? And it gets to a high point in the 1990s where we have love marks and all that shit. Mm-hmm. And Berenberg Bass, they come in and completely level things out and say, no, this is all completely, we're smoking our own weed here. You know, it's mostly about just coming to mind, being distinctive, standing out at the right moments, etc. But by doing that, as Berenberg Bass always do, with all this talk of science, let us not forget they're a corporate entity with members. They're a profit-generating organization, not dissimilar from Kantar. They rhetorically push the agenda in the other direction too far, in my opinion. They belittle differentiation as if it's, you know, unique selling propositions and straw man differentiation. No one believes in that. No one has done in 50 years. You can't own an attribute. You can't have some unique thing. You know, a fool would believe that. What you can have is relative superiority, even when you control for size, on a couple of important associations that will make the difference. And strategy is about choosing the right ones and doubling down on them and making them clear. That's differentiation, relative, modern, realistic differentiation.
Yeah.
I see no reason why you can't have that alongside distinctiveness. They don't have to be enemies. It's again nonsense. But the idea that most marketers at the moment are falling for this nonsense that all brands are perceived to be the same, it's embarrassing. You know, that's not true, for God's sake. You know, we might be able to prove that they're all the same or they're not all the same, but just clearly there are certain associations for certain brands which tip us over the edge. It's not just salience. I freely accept that salience is a huge part of it, maybe the bigger part of it for most brands. But I also believe that there is a quotient of this which is based around how is the brand perceived by the consumer. And I see apps. I mean, I worked for LVMH for 15 years in Paris, Mm-hmm. You know, long before Ehrenberg Bass were banging on about distinctive assets and all that, we worked on all of our brands from Louis Vuitton down with the precept that there were two goals. There was brand DNA, le lame de la maison, the position of the brand, right? The source of differentiation, what we stand for. And there were the brand codes, the distinctive brand assets. And, you know, I spent my life working on those brands. So we were clear on what were the, in modern language, the distinctive assets and what was the positioning or DNA. And I still think that's the right approach. And I think any brand should have that on a page of paper. This is what we want to communicate. This is our personality, our image, our mantra, our purpose. Don't care what you call it, but keep it tight. This is what we want the consumer to think of us, right? This is what we stand for. And then these are the distinctive assets by which we stand out, step forward, become noticed. That, for me, is the central theory. Now, I love Ehrenberg Bass's work because it's pushed so hard distinctiveness, which is crucial. Mm-hmm. And I hate the work that has, you know, seven different terminologies for brand positioning, brand values, brand essence, brand this, brand that. It gets in the way. Positioning has become an end in itself. The great brands are the ones that have a single slide, which has four or five things they're positioning on and four or five distinctive assets at most. And they use that to run their show. That's what great brands look like in my experience, you know. And of course, it takes true great marketers to define a $1 billion brand in a single slide with five or six words. We don't normally get those people. We get average people who need a slide deck and 400 words and six concepts. You know, complexity and intelligence breeds simplicity. Mm. And that's something sometimes missing from our industry, you know?
Yeah, you're right. You can't probably, probably own anything, not for long anyway, but you can go beyond those borders of distinctiveness to find product-based, experience-based, emotionally-based differences that will break through those expectations of parity. And we have found that brands that actually achieve a differentiated brand positioning can even lower customer price sensitivity from our...
Well, that's the key point, Mary. And again, missing from the Ehrenberg Bass work. Yeah, if you just look purely at revenues and sales, there's probably stronger arguments. But the minute you get to the long-held propensity for brand equity to reduce price sensitivity, we're in a different world. We're in a different world straight away, right? And that's probably more important than any other facet of brand equity. Well, I'd say there's two things that brand equity delivers, right? What's the value of brand equity? There are many things. But the two most important are the ability to generate a price, which is spectacularly important if you understand profitability. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is the ability to create brand extensions. You can't extend a brand that has no brand associations, that has no brand equity. And over time, and we're talking 20, 30 years, the thing about brands is...
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Brand associations open doors into new categories, which allow a brand to live on and live forever. That's a super important thing as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep.
Now, you were asked on another podcast about the greatest challenge for marketers for this year, and with confidence, always, yeah, you responded inflation and getting the price right, especially time during, especially now, rather, during a time of inflation. Now, there was a big chapter. It was within the module about pricing, and I think there was a point in there about, you know, do marketers even consider this to be part of their job? And you know, some of them don't, and I suppose that could potentially be the root of the problem. But the reality is that you will have to, in a year like that, and or in the years that will follow, you will have to be involved in that. You will have to deal with the pricing and do get it right. But in all likelihood, they will also have to engage in a pricing war, maybe, right? If the whole category does it, if their competitors do it, what chances do they have of not getting stuck into a pricing war?
Well, there's a couple of things, right? So the classic lesson of, well, two things. Yes, we're about to enter a recession which also has inflation. So those are two contradictory forces. It happens occasionally, right? It hasn't happened since the 70s in most markets. There's a real problem coming. Recessions slow things down, typically freeze prices, economy crunches and slows down. Inflation, everything speeds up, cost of living goes up, prices go up, etc. So we're going to experience both. So there's a really unique period coming. And there are a couple of want marketers involved in pricing. Even though I would say the majority now are effectively just communications people, right? So the problem we have with marketers in companies is, and most of them don't realize this, they're only doing 8% of the marketing role. They're working on advertising and communications and digital comms. Their tactical capabilities don't expand into product or distribution or pricing, and they have no strategic input, right? So mm-hmm. they're effectively less than 10% functional, yeah? The reason that's a shame is because if you don't understand value, perceived value, brands, etc., you're going to leave money on the table and get pricing wrong. It's the first reason, right? You're going to get it. You're going to underprice, which is a classic error of what happens when you price without marketers involved, good marketers. And the second thing is, especially when we get to inflation, where we're going to have to increase prices or we're going to go backwards with the same price, there's an art to changing a price. So in my world, I split pricing up into the price setting activity, the price itself that results from that price setting, and then the communication of that price and how we frame and contextualize it. Yeah. There is no doubt that ultimately the most important part of that triptych is the third one, how the price is presented. Right. How it's framed, contextualized, communicated, presented. That certainly applies to price increases, in which if you communicate them correctly, you signal they're coming, you explain in simple terms why it has to be done, you remind the consumer of the value, you call it a price increase, you don't disguise it or try and slip it in around the edges, right? You're much more likely to get through that price rise in good shape and help the organization to stay profitable.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about the price war point that you raise is it's pretty clear that once a price war begins, everybody's f***ed, okay? Like I would imagine, I don't know much about this, with actual war, that, you know, the challenge is to ensure that the war never breaks out in the first place. So you signal to your competitors, if you ever did drop your price, we'd go lower than you and we could survive longer. Doesn't mean you do that. You've got to find a way of signaling, don't go there. You know, if they ever do it in one little limited market, you should go in with both boots and send a very clear signal. We will outlast you and we will out undercut you and we will press the red button. Don't do it again. See what I mean?
Yeah. Okay.
But I think the big emphasis on pricing right now is handling price increases with a marketing focus. Yeah.
Yeah.
That, for me, that's the most important thing, because we're going to have to do a few of them. you know, handling the price rise is a really significant challenge. And the last thing about price is, if you're obsessed with revenues and selling product, you don't get it. Price is the lifeblood of every company, right? The other thing that's going to happen in a recession right now, Mary, is that all these companies that didn't make any money, yeah, like the Ubers and WeWorks, right?
Yeah.
That era's over, man. That era. There's two things annoying me. Companies that don't make a profit and companies that think failing is good. Failing is never good. Failing is bad, really bad. Because you know why? Because it's failure. Well, you have to fail to learn. Sure you do. When there's not a recession, when everyone's got loads of money, we can fail. That time is over, Mary. It's a recession. There'll be no failing and there'll be no more purpose work. There'll be making money. It's back in fashion, baby. It's back in fashion. You know what I mean? Suddenly everyone's going to be like, oh, we have to make a profit, right? Because you know what? We're going to survive otherwise. You know what I mean? So I think pricing is back on the agenda big time.
Now, you've always been a supporter of MDF. And I know you've been a supporter of the Meaningfully Different framework, because your exact wording in your Bodhism article from a couple of years ago was that we've been a very polite way of saying we've been politely proving that the combination of salience and meaningful difference is greater than the sum of those two parts. And yes, we've been doing this for years. And you often reference, you do it on the course and you do it in podcasts as well, Jim Collins and his notion of the tyranny of war and the genius of end. But still, I find that as an industry, we tend to do more of the or and less of the end. Is this an industry thing or a human behavior thing?
It's a limited intelligence thing. Right. Yeah. And I don't mean necessarily stupid. I just mean people that aren't developed intellectually. You know, whoever it was, I forget now, is it Bertrand Russell? Whoever it is. Anyway, the definition of intelligence is holding two contradictory ideas in your head at the same time. It's literally the definition of intelligence. But we work in an industry where you have to pick distinctiveness or differentiation, top of funnel or bottom of funnel. Do you know what I mean? Sales or marketing, creativity or media. It's tiresome, right? It's tiresome. When in reality, and to be fair to Kantar, they've done a brilliant empirical job of saying, we don't disagree with coming to mind, with brute awareness, but it doesn't explain the full picture. And without undermining that focus on salience, saying, look, meaningful difference also plays a role here. And I think the work has been really focused and really good and doesn't get a lot of criticism. It's just kind of ignored if it doesn't fit the salience uber alles argument, you know? So, yeah, no, I think I have been a big fan of Kantar's on that, because I think they've stuck to their guns throughout the last 15 years. And, you know, you've, like me, you've definitely absorbed the Ehrenberg Bath stuff, which has pushed more salience and system one. I think that's great. But you've also stuck to your guns and gone, but also there has to be meaning here. There has to be association on top of the brute salience. And I think it's turning out to be proven over time. And I think Kantar's been great on that one for sure.
Thank you. Thank you. And you should read our latest stuff about the role of connections and how marketing creates value for a company by increasing mental and physical, not availability, but connectivity between the brand and its consumers and its stakeholders. It's a great narrative. And we're building on that continuously. I'm going to finish off with a question I asked you on the course. It was in one of the Q&A sessions. And I asked you about how brands create value for businesses. I think I knew that from what we were saying, but how vibrant brands can actually stay at the top of their game, how can keep maintain their sharpness. And you gave me it wasn't funny, but it was a broad answer, but it actually resonated very well with me. You talked about healthy paranoia. And you said that people who never stop and to smell the roses succeed in that, in staying, I suppose, relevant. And you I don't know if you remember now the example, but you, and I don't remember it very well, but it was an example with Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, and what happened to him during one of the trips. But you can tell me about that. But also what I would like to know is, what do we, can a consultant have that? Can an employee of a company have that healthy paranoia, or an agency that is working with a brand, you think?
I've spent my life working for brands that were once very vibrant and then became dusty, ironically, because they have tried to stay consistent, but over time become inconsistent from themselves. And that's a, you know, it's a paradox. What happens is brands, for a brand like Kantar to be true to itself and its position, it has to do different things in the 30s coming up than it did in the 1990s, right? So the paradox is, for a brand to remain consistent over time, it has to change. And I think that paranoia is the engine of that change, that you're constantly being street smart, you're constantly seeing the way the world is changing, and you're constantly questioning, what does it mean for us to represent this now? And being comfortable with change. And I think that's, again, one of the great lessons. There's only a few brands that have been able to straddle long periods of time and not become dusty. Chanel, BMW, Walmart, you know, they've done it for decades, and it's very impressive. And I think paranoia is at the heart of that success.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I love that answer. I think I have a little bit of that, even though I'm working for an agency. And I think maybe the way I would describe it is, in what I see as a characteristic for us, we're very, very, very curious. We're always curious. And sometimes curiosity takes you to places where, you know, you need to evolve or change things, or certainly further validate. But if you retain that curiosity, it doesn't have to come with a sleepless night that maybe healthy paranoia would give you. But you're going to get to the same great results. I'm going to see you in September online, because I'm joining the mini MBA in marketing, in brand management.
Great. You will love it, Mary. I'm telling you, it's right up your street. Right up your street.
Thank you. I can't wait to see if I'm going to have as many proud moments as I had the last time. And I say that because you were mentioning a number of agencies, but there was a lot of data that I could actually recognize, and it was coming from Kantar.
You'll see even more in September. I mean, it's brand stuff, right? So it's right up your alley. But I'll get my entertainment watching you in the simulation. You know, you build a brand plan, and then you run the brand plan in a 5-year simulation. We're just finishing it for the April course now. People just lose their shit over this. So watching you go through that will give me great entertainment for the...
Do you do this throughout the course rather than at the very
end? So you build the brand plan week by week. So when we teach distinctive brand assets, you pick the distinctive brand assets for your brand. And gradually you build this brand plan. And then when it's finished, you launch it into the simulated market, and your grade is the share price of your company at the end of the 5 years. It's hot. So, you trust me, around about Christmas, you'll be losing your shit, much to my entertainment.
Great. I mean, you know, if you you entertain us, so we should entertain you too. Do you appear semi-naked on this one too?
I'm trying to think if there's much naked. No, I tell you what I do. I use stand-in naked men with harder bodies. You'll see. The time comes, I promise everyone it's a harder class than the marketing class. And when the naked dudes turn up, they've got much harder bodies than me, which is not bad. So that's my promise. Yeah, we get some
compensate. Right.
Yeah, we compensate with harder professional, younger bodies. So. Yeah. There'll be a bit of. There's always a lot of nudity. You need nudity in a training program, but not from me this time.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. It's very late for you. Well, kind of.
My pleasure.
And so I thank you even more for that.
I'll see you in class in September. Keep up the good work, and see you after the summer.
And you too.
See you after. Enjoy winter. Bye, Mary. Bye.
You've been listening to Future Proof, the marketing podcast from Said Business School and Kantar. Find more episodes and related content at uk.kantar.com or at sbs.oxford.edu. Thank you.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.